This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, a new report confirms that the decade of the 2010s was the hottest ever measured on Earth. We'll have more on that. And we also look at what to expect from 2020 on how Australia might handle the issue of its climate change policies with its Pacific neighbours.
What we're going to see in 2020 is a recognition both in Australia and in the region that if the Australian Pacific step up is going to be successful in the longer term, what needs to happen is there needs to be a closer alignment of domestic Australian policy with how Australia wants to engage with the region when it comes to foreign policy.
Meanwhile, thousands of Pacific Islanders living and working on farms in remote Australia. We take a look at what is being done to protect them during this catastrophic bushfire season.
Farmers are pretty sensible about this. Normally the employer would say, stop work, let's go somewhere safe. If that doesn't happen, then the worker has the right under law to say, I don't feel safe, I'm going to stop work. So most farmers would have a contingency plan for their workers or their operation, their farm, in a bushfire situation.
For more on that story and more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First, though, this morning, in the wake of an explosive documentary that alleged corruption and abuse within PNG's logging industry, a local member of parliament says that authorities will investigate the companies involved. Now, despite once welcoming that sort of business, Elias Kapavore of Pomio in PNG's East New Britain now admits that very little benefit has been gained from the years of timber and palm oil extraction. Now, this comes after the UK-based Sarawak report in its documentary claimed that communities are being recklessly exploited by foreign logging companies and that PNG authorities are ignoring their pleas. Priyanka Srinivasan has the story.
The once pristine vast island of Papua New Guinea has been captured by timber raiders.
Colonialism in Papua New Guinea. That's how Sarawak Report journalist Claire Rucastle-Brown describes the logging industry in PNG's East New Britain. Her new documentary alleges abuse at the hands of Malaysian companies, of village men and women caged in shipping containers for protesting logging, workers left unprotected as they fell trees and carry timber, and labourers without access to water, sanitation or electricity.
I got the evidence from people's own stories, from their own mouths, as to how these incredibly wealthy companies have been deliberately and ruthlessly moving in on their lands and ripping out billions and billions of dollars worth of timber, for which no recompense has gone back to the people of Papua New Guinea.
The documentary was released as part of a months-long investigation conducted by the UK-based media company. It also claims PNG authorities have turned a blind eye to the plight of villages in Pomio.
Foreign operators misled and bribed local leaders, set up puppet native landowner companies, bribed provincial government premiers or ministers, and gave gifts or bribes.
I saw every form of fraudulent activity that you could care to mention was indulged in. Fake signatures, fake landowners, fake landowner companies, people thinking they were signing to say they'd attended a meeting when in fact they'd signed away their rights to the land. People who thought they were hiring an agent, whereas in fact they'd signed power of attorney for the entire area that they were responsible for as the landowner companies. The mass fraud on a extraordinary level.
The local member of Pomio, Elias Kapavore, says he was surprised by the film and he supports those speaking out about the logging companies.
After seeing it today, firstly, I believe we have learned many lessons from this particular arrangement that has led to this current situation where we see the former directors coming out now and saying openly or publicly that they are no longer happy with the way that the company is now running its activities in the district. And I tend to support them in their view as well.
Mr. Kapavore was once a vocal supporter of the Malaysian logging and palm oil companies in his electorate. In 2017, speaking with local broadcaster MTV, the Pomio MP said it was a privilege to work with them as they brought development to remote areas.
So we need partners, and we are privileged to have Zenigini here, and we are privileged to have RH towards in West Papua Mamosi going towards Melkoi. Without these development partners, some of our people will still continue to walk the mountains today. They will not. They actually have not ridden in trucks for the last 40 years. I support the company, and I also I'm here on behalf of my people.
But today, Mr. Capovori says local landowners have not seen much of that promised wealth.
Yes, I can admit that we have not seen any tangible benefit with regard to support to social activities like schools, health, despite the fact that they're doing roads, most of those roads are within their own business activities.
Though he would not say if any charges would be laid against the accused companies, Mr. Capovori said agreements needed to be revisited to ensure a fairer deal.
I believe what has happened has happened. We just have to revisit the existing arrangements and improve from here.
He also says he will contact the companies featured in the film and investigate the landowners' concerns.
I'm going to write a letter to the company and express some of these concerns raised by the people. I will also go and speak to my district CEO and we can get some of the landowners and speak to some of the landowner groups.
Claire Rucastle-Brown says she tried to reach out to government and law enforcement officials as part of her documentary, but they were unable to answer questions on tape. But she says landowners are calling for government to take action.
There's an awareness now on the ground. And also, I think that has played into an awareness that there needs to be changed at government level in Papua New Guinea.
Claire Rucastle-Brown there, journalist of that documentary. Our reporter was Priyanka Srinivasan. Now, Pacific Beat has reached out to Rimbunan Hijau, the Malaysian logging company operating in Pomio, but they haven't answered our requests for an interview. And we're also seeking responses from both PNG's police and forestry officials about some of the claims made in that documentary. Well, the decade that just ended was by far the hottest ever measured on Earth. Now, climate scientists say that even though the latest global report confirms just what they were expecting, it still makes for sobering reading. And they're warning that that heat is likely to lead to more extreme weather events in the future, such as we're seeing already with the Australian bushfires, as Isabel Rowe reports.
Australia has just chalked up its hottest year on record, and this morning, confirmation it's part of a global trend.
This makes the 2019 ending the warmest five-year period, 2015 to 2019, and the warmest decade. So this means that each decade since 1980s is warmer than the previous one.
World Meteorological Organization scientist Omar Badour says the latest global climate figures paint a definitive picture of temperature increases on land and sea. Data from the organization, NASA, and the UK Met Office found the temperature in 2019 was 1.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. It was the second hottest year on record. Omar Badour says temperatures are predicted to keep rising.
2016 was about 1.2 global temperature increase. The next El Nino in 2, 3, 5 years is easily exceeding 1.3, 1.4 degrees centigrade.
He's worried about the creep towards the globally agreed limit of 1.5 degrees.
We are concerned about the figures that we produce compared to the targets of Paris Agreement. We can say that we can raise red flag now because we really not only see the warming, but we see the consequences on lives and people. I wouldn't say I am not optimistic, but this is the facts. Yeah.
The World Meteorological Organization notes extreme weather is already happening. Omar Badour cites unprecedented bushfires like those we're seeing in Australia and elsewhere.
Wildfires have been also one of the most noticeable events during 2019, even in areas where fires are very rare, like in the Arctic region.
The report also suggests warming above 1.5 degrees will melt most Arctic sea ice, where the Finnish icebreaker MSV Nordica used to sail through thick ice in the Northwest Passage of Canada. Ice navigator David Snyder says it's now melting earlier and for longer each year.
I've been coming up here since the early 1980s, and it's very apparent to me that there's dramatic changes in the overall extent and thickness of ice. Where we used to see heavy multi-year ice, many meters thick, now we're seeing much thinner ice and much less ice.
And if that 1.5 degree rise is reached, this report and other climate science predicts coral reefs will die, with Sunday's diving instructor Tony Fonts watches that process every day.
Unfortunately, the ocean temperature increasing has not been kind to the reef because it creates a phenomenon known as coral bleaching, I'm sure most people are familiar with, which is potentially deadly for corals.
And like dozens of reports before it, the World Meteorological Organization warns the increasing amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere must be curbed to slow the rise in temperature. Tony Fonts wants the research taken seriously.
I'm hoping this report will spur our leaders into making serious changes to our carbon emission, and we become a leader in reducing carbon emissions.
That's Tony Fonts, the diving instructor in Australia. Isabel Rowe, our reporter there. Well, meanwhile, a leading Pacific commentator says that the year 2020 is going to be crunch time for Australia in terms of how it engages with the Pacific on the issue of climate change. Of course, it's a topic that did cause significant division last year that escalated at the annual meeting of Pacific leaders in Tuvalu in August, when Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison was accused of, quote, insulting and condescending behaviour. Here's Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama speaking at the time.
I was gravely disappointed that the language coming out of our final communique and that Australia fails to recognise climate change for what it is, a global crisis. I, along with my fellow Pacific heads of government, will continue to push the region's largest carbon emitter to transition from coal to clean energy and continue to be a voice for all climate vulnerable peoples.
It was reported at the time that Mr. Morrison had refused to give ground on several issues being pushed by Pacific leaders. That meant that references to coal and also plans of how to achieve net zero emissions by the year 2050 were actually removed from the final communique of the 2019 PIF. Now, of course, in recent days, there's in light of the ongoing bushfire crisis here in Australia, the government's climate policies have been coming under renewed scrutiny. Mr. Morrison has signalled this week a possible shift, and he's made it clear that the government does believe that climate change is real. However, several of his backbenchers have publicly questioned the science of climate change. Now, Australia's Science Minister Karen Andrews yesterday sent a blunt message to them on that issue, and there have been direct messages from Pacific leaders as well on this matter. The Pacific commentator Dr. Tess Newton-Cain says that when they do all come together again for PIF, which is being hosted by Vanuatu this year, Australia's already been asked to come with a very different approach.
It's fairly clear that Vanuatu's already made it clear, and the current foreign minister of Vanuatu basically sort of put it out in the open in the immediate aftermath of what happened last year, that come 2020, when the leaders meet in Port Vila, that Australia is expected to be better prepared, to have a better conversation to bring, to have a better tone of engagement with Pacific countries, particularly around this issue of climate change. It's an issue that has been front of mind for Pacific countries for quite some time. It didn't suddenly appear out of nowhere last year. It's central to the Boy Declaration, to which all Pacific Forum members are signatories, and it underpins a lot of what will go into the 2050 strategy, which we're expecting to see a draft of at the leaders' meeting. So there are lots of things in place that mean that this is very much going to be the big ticket item when the Pacific Island Forum leaders meet. The current situation in Australia with the bushfire crisis and the conversations arising out of that, including very recent comments made by Scott Morrison about potential for changing emissions targets and how that might be taken. Obviously, come August, when the leaders meet, we'll be looking to see how, if at all, those conversations have influenced domestic politics and policy here in Australia, and how that has fed through to what Australia takes to the forum.
And if it doesn't take a different stance by that stage, I mean, what then from Pacific leaders? They've made it pretty clear. You said Ralph Regan-Vanu as well. The Vanuatu foreign minister has made it very clear as well, after essentially, you know, it would be several years running of Australia coming to this meeting with a certain stance and having conflict with Pacific leaders. could that happen a third time, or would that really cause some sort of final division? And that goes back to the Pacific step up and the relationship that Australia is trying to have with the region.
I think the underlying point here is that what we're going to see in 2020 is a recognition both in Australia and in the region that if the Australian Pacific step up is going to be successful in the longer term, what needs to happen is there needs to be a closer alignment of domestic Australian policy with how Australia wants to engage with the region when it comes to foreign policy. Climate change is one area where there's quite a significant division, and there are other areas. And increasingly, what everyone's going to need to realise is that those have to come closer together. And that's what we'll be looking for come the meeting of forum leaders. I think there is the potential for there to be further divisions and conflicts. We've seen increasingly over the years that Pacific leaders are much more prepared to be openly critical of Australia's position, whereas previously they may have been a bit more discreet, or a bit, you know, kept it to a subtext. They're prepared to go on the record and say openly critical things. And I think that if Australia's position is not able to change sufficiently or quickly enough, we will see more of that. And we will also see Pacific Island countries, both singly and in groups, making much more of other forums where they can operate without feeling constrained by the Australian position, such as at the UN, FCCC and at COP26 in Glasgow.
It's Dr. Tess Newton-Cain. She's an associate of the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University and has written for them her predictions of 2020 in the Pacific. And keen to know what you make of some of the things she's talked about. Do you agree, disagree, think there are others as well? We will be looking tomorrow at her thoughts on the next steps for Bougainville and PNG after last year's very much overwhelming independence referendum win there, and also what that might mean this year for some of the other independence movements in the region. If you want to get in touch with us and let us know your thoughts too, do so via the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. You can send us a message there.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, seasonal workers from the Pacific have been caught up in Australia's ongoing bushfire crisis, raising questions just how transient workers like them are looked after in times of an emergency. A major trade union here in Australia says that employers are responsible for their workers' safety and should have contingency plans in place for emergencies like bushfires. Now, for one group of Vanuatu workers, though, it was the support of their community that really made the difference in their recent close call with a bushfire, as Evan Wasuka reports.
Unprecedented bushfires have decimated Australia's southeast, with seasonal workers from the Pacific among those at the front line. Out of the 150 Pacific labourers working in fire-affected areas of New South Wales and Victoria, a third of them were evacuated from a farm near Batlow in recent weeks, as fire roared through.
We had a phone call at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, before New Year's Day. They had to relocate 54 people, and we received those people at 10 o'clock New Year's Eve at the motel.
Kerry Pascoe is a city councillor and business owner at Wagga Wagga, northwest of Batlow. His motel became home for the workers for 12 days, with a local community chipping in to provide food.
It was really an event to have those guys taking them around town, introducing them to people, letting them sing for the community because they know what the community was doing for them.
Vanuatu worker James Wallau told Radio Australia he was moved by the community's response. Fortunately, the workers were able to return to work, with the farm suffering only minor damages to its apple trees. But with bushfire conditions still prevalent, the danger is far from over. Peter Soliaki is a seasonal worker in Victoria and an advocate for workers' rights.
Imagine if someone from the Pacific comes here, you know, in a foreign land, and then doesn't have the information or the right tools in place to deal with issues like this.
Mr. Soliaki says the scale of bushfires would have been a shock for anyone, let alone Pacific Island workers.
I'm not sure if most of the people coming in know what to do in an emergency. But I believe that's what they've been briefed about, and I'm just thinking maybe the information is, you know, just listen to your leaders or listen to those you're responsible because they know what you're doing.
The seasonal workers scheme is an arrangement between the Government of Australia and the Pacific governments. But the safety of workers is the responsibility of employers. In a statement, the Department of Employment, Skills, Small and Family Business said,
approved employers have responsibility for the day-to-day safety of workers they employ. This includes in an emergency. The department ensures that the approved employers are aware of their obligations in relation to the seasonal workers they employ. The department has a 24-hour emergency number for seasonal workers and improved employers to call.
Shane Ralston is with Australian Workers Union.
Farmers are pretty sensible about this. Normally the employer would say, stop work, let's go somewhere safe. If that doesn't happen, then the worker has a right under law to say, I don't feel safe, I'm going to stop work.
Mr Ralston says on the whole, the union has had a good response from farmers.
So most farmers would have a contingency plan for their workers or their operation, their farm, in a bushfire situation. There might be some that don't, but most would.
Mr Ralston says at the end of the day, seasonal workers have the same protection as Australian workers, and safety in the fire season is paramount.
Evan Wasuka reporting there for us. Well, tomorrow marks 1 month since the Australian government began a trial easing restrictions on the amount of kava that can be imported into the country for personal use. Kava lovers are now able to bring in 4 kilograms of the substance instead of the usual 2, and that change came just in time for their Christmas celebrations. As Nick Fogarty reports, though, some say the restrictions still need to be loosened further, with claims that allowing commercial exports as well would dramatically boost Pacific economies.
Reverend Miley Malatika is the president of the Brisbane Tongan community and a member of the Sia Mili Kava Club. He says this festive season was especially sweet, with the kava flowing even more freely than usual.
It was exciting news because most of the kava clubs here in Brisbane, sometimes they are running out. 2 kilos was not enough for the personal use. And I think the news comes in a good time during the Christmas season.
Male Malatika says there are about 10 kava clubs in Brisbane, made up of members from Pacific countries like Tonga, Fiji and Samoa, who get together once a week or so to play music, study the Bible and, of course, share in some kava, the psychoactive drink made from the ground-up kava root. Reverend Malatika says kava is one of the most important parts of his culture.
This is the meeting point for every occasion in our culture. We have kava when we're celebrating birthdays or anniversaries, or whatever you can name it, weddings, and also funerals, kava. We'll be there, you know, to welcome people who are coming to a funeral and also when we socialise on a Friday or Saturday night.
In the week the restrictions were lifted, local media in Fiji reported excitement among kava dealers in Suva Market, who predicted that it would boost their business. Reverend Malatika says the price of kava in Brisbane has subsequently dropped from about $150 to less than $100 a kilo, matching falls in Tonga to around $80 a kilo. But for Vanuatu-based kava exporter Michael Luz, who services growing kava bar scenes in New Caledonia and the United States, there hasn't been a noticeable change where he is.
We haven't really noticed any difference. There had been no impact on the kava exports from Vanuatu side and no impact on our economy, of course.
While kava clubs in Brisbane and other communities rejoice, a ban on commercial imports of kava remains in place, and kava is still entirely prohibited in Western Australia and the Northern Territory. Kava has been blamed for causing problems in remote Indigenous communities, and there are claims, which its advocates strongly reject, that it causes lingering health effects. In keeping with its Pacific step-up, though, the current Australian government's announced they'll begin a commercial import trial by the end of 2020. Michael Luz says kava is one of the few products where Pacific Island producers can compete in the global market, and he's urging Australia to open itself up if it's serious about building a closer relationship.
We have this great opportunity with kava, which is only produced in the South Pacific. So if Australia is really genuine, helping us, trying to promote our product, this will really help us with the products which are making a difference. And kava is a product which is making a huge difference in our island. If you go to Penticos, if you go to Santo, our farmers are buying truck, buying boats, just with kava money. All the kids in Penticos, probably 99% of the kids are going their school fees with kava money.
It is the Vanuatu-based kava exporter Michael Luze there, and that report from Nick Fogarty, an issue that still won't go away. We'll continue to cover it for you here on Pacific Beach. But for the moment, that's all for us today. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for listening. You have a great day.